This is CliffCentral.com.
Good morning and welcome to Disrupt with Mpumi Nhlapo. Thank you for joining us once again. On this show, we focus on immersive disruption, and we have in-depth conversations with industry leaders, thought leaders, and individuals that can really understand how to navigate this fast-changing world that we exist in today. In the studio with me today, I've got someone who is not unfamiliar to Cliff Central, a well-known journalist, trend analyst, a thought leader, and really someone who's helped to guide South African Africans on how to exist in this fast-changing world, how to adapt as trends change. Dion Chang, welcome to Disrupt with Mpumi Nhlapo. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here again.
Thank you for joining me. Dion, you speak a lot. I mean, you spend a lot of time with different audiences. You speak with different hats on.
Yes.
And today we really want to distill this wealth of knowledge that we have and really focus it around how, you know, this mantra that you push about how disruption is business strategy, how trends can influence business strategy.
Yes.
Flux Trends, your company, before we get into the topic, can you just tell us a little bit about the company, what it does, and also the name, how that came about?
Sure. We celebrated our 10th anniversary last year, so we must be doing something right that we managed to run for a whole decade. Flux started as back then, I think there was still a lot of information that's just being flung around. I mean, it's just increased exponentially now.
Mm.
But I started Flux as an information distillation service because I just thought that there was just too much information out and people just needed to get those kind of bite-sized ways of looking at things. But my methodology from the start, so this is really going old school, because what I did as a hobby was actually clip newspaper articles that interested me. And at the end of the year, I would just start sorting them into different piles. So I had a political pile, I had a technology pile, I had a, you know, medical or whatever.
As a hobby.
Culture, as a hobby.
Before you even started the company.
Before I even started.
Wow.
And I was just interested in seeing where all of this information would start clumping and where all of these patterns would start emerging.
Okay.
And I remember one of the things that I clipped, and it's strange that it stuck in my head because it's formed part of the methodology that we do. So the different pillars is very important because I saw from that what we were losing in an information age was interconnectivity.
Okay.
So the effect of politics, of the economy, of tech or whatever, had a knock-on effect on something else.
I see.
So for me, that and looking cross-industry is hyper, hyper important because I think so many people look at their own industries with blinkers on because you're just trying to cope. You can't absorb all of that information. But if you put those blinkers on, you miss out on what's happening in other industries, which is probably going to come and hit your industry anyway.
Yeah,
there's interconnectivity. Your generation gap gets wider. You put those blinkers on and it's to your detriment. So that's what we try and do. And about sort of halfway through the 10 years, I pivoted my own business model, and we started looking at trends as business strategy because we were sort of falling into the trap of where most research companies fall, which is just looking at consumer mindset. But I thought that was a little bit too one-dimensional. I wanted to go a little bit deeper. So we went into trends as business strategy, and coincidentally, but obviously I was feeling some kind of a trend tremor, we looked at disruption, when disruption was just starting. So the whole digitization process, all of the new tech that was sort of coming in, social media was just hitting its stride and really sort of embedding itself into not just passing of information, but, you know, Twitter being a breaking news platform. All of those things were starting to crystallize.
Okay.
And so for the last 5 years, I've really focused on disruption, so much so that somebody said, oh, you that disruption management consultant. Yeah, okay, I'll take that one.
Absolutely, yeah. Coin a new phrase.
So we've started building on that. And then one of the most surprising things, but one that gives me great joy, is about 2 or 3 years ago, started to be invited by the different business schools to actually lecture a trends module, a trends business strategy module, to senior management and to executives. So I thought that was a really strange twist of fate.
Because at the time you'd been focused more on the consumer side.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
And so it just told me that pivot was a really good pivot and the right pivot.
Yes.
And what I see over and over again to your opening and about disruption is that I think people understand that there's disruption. They're not quite sure what to do and how to implement those changes. And that's what we do, is we really start looking at it holistically and trying to connect all the dots, as is our methodology, and looking at different factors, but specifically looking at company cultures and the skills within that company, because
yes,
companies face disruption and say, okay, this external thing's going to hit us, how do we do it? But they don't examine internally what they should change or how they should change and adapt. And you can see, well, I can see on a daily basis, the templates of business we use are spawned in the 20th century. So you've got, you know, your labor laws, your the work structure, the quaint 9-to-5
yes,
we're still forced to do, even though we're all remote workers, the siloed ways of companies, the hierarchical ways of companies, those are not conducive to being adaptive or very agile, and that's why you're seeing a lot of companies just struggle with the whole thing, you know. And the one thing that surprises me over and above everything mm-hmm. is that and these are really big companies, big corporates as
yes.
well, are still struggling with the concept of digital transformation.
Yes.
Where you think, but we've been on this path for a decade already.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We should be get to the program. There's a whole second wave of disruption coming. There's robots, there's automation, there's algorithms, there's AI, there's all of these kind of things coming, and we're still trying to digitize. I was like, need to speed it up.
Is it not because they're navigating these massive ships? You know, I
yes.
mean, and that you know, when you're on this ship, it's almost like you're existing in your own universe, in effect.
Sure.
And so the things that happen around you, it's difficult to grasp how quickly they're coming at you and how quickly they can have an impact on
and it. I think that's the problem. There's almost like a perfect storm that's brewing. So you've got a really sluggish economy, and in South Africa we're in a recession, we've got
yeah.
high rates of unemployment, you've got all of these external factors. So just keeping your head above water and keeping your doors open
yeah.
is like a badge of honor nowadays. It's like, you've done well, you've
survived.
You've survived.
Yes.
You're not Stutterfords. You didn't like just close the doors and, you know, after 159 years.
Mm.
So while that is a badge of honor, what a lot of companies don't do, because they see it as a nice to have, is look into the future bucket and look at future strategies
yeah.
and what's changing there. So we're in survival mode, so we look at that, but I think that's a little bit too short-sighted, because in this day and age it happens so quickly that we really need to look into that other bucket and invest a lot more time and energy into it
and understanding it.
Yeah.
So I know you went on a tour in the United States.
Yes.
And you studied about 50 different companies.
Yes. It was an innovation tour.
An innovation tour.
Yeah.
Can you take us through that a little bit in terms of, you know, kind of what the key objectives were? Because I know what you had anticipated going on the tour and what it actually ended up in
lightning.
It was
yes,
very different.
Yeah.
Can you talk through that a little bit?
It was a fun tour because it was in New York.
Fantastic.
It was an exhausting tour because, like you said, in 1 week, we did visited 50
oh, different. Oh, was that 1 week? I didn't realize
week,
it was 1 week.
In 1 week.
Okay.
So some of them were just, you know, popping into retail concepts. The reason what attracted me to that tour was the fact that they looked cross industry. So we visited everything from 3D printing factories, some amazing like product design companies, architectural firms, advertising agencies.
Fantastic.
It was just all over the place. So I was going there to see what that holy grail was of innovation, because I think every single company, that word innovation, you've got, you know, your CEO or the executives, the exco saying, we want innovation.
Yes.
So you're going, well, how are you going to do that? You know, it's like this entity. It's like, we want innovation.
Yeah.
You must go and find innovation and do innovation.
Bring someone who can make
yeah,
us innovative.
It's that's a bit of an intangible. So when I came back from that trip, what dawned on me was that all of those companies had a uniquely different operating system. They did not operate anything like the corporate structures in business that we see today.
Okay.
And it makes a lot of sense because, you know, this thing going around saying, you know, your traditional legacy companies are 80 years old, yeah. almost 100 years old.
Yes.
And your new agile companies have a lifespan of about 15 years. It's not to say that they just die and disappear, but they reinvent themselves and they keep pivoting. After those 15 years there, they completely reinvent themselves there. And so when people say to me, you know, we're a proud legacy company, we've been around for those 80 years.
Weathered the storm for many years.
I wouldn't shout that out too loud in this day and age because it actually means that you are siloed, you're very hierarchical, and you are that big ship that you mentioned that you can't turn around very, very quickly. And we're in this era where you need to make those quick decisions and be able to move and be able to turn that ship around much, much faster.
Yeah.
I know it's a really difficult thing, especially for the bigger the corporate is.
Yes.
And I'm privy to those kind of things because, like you said, I speak a lot. So, you know, whether it's a big bank or a big telecommunications company, you know, I will either work with the ops guys or the retail guys or whatever. So you understand that there's a lot of pieces in the big jigsaw to make up this company.
Yes.
And trying to communicate one message throughout that company is really, really difficult, but it's very, very necessary. And some of those are some of the learnings, if you want me to go through, you know, from that innovation tour, that were a stark reminder of how we need to do things very, very differently.
Okay.
So the one thing that I find, and I think everybody who's listening has got their own bank story where they've been throwing a phone against a wall or yeah. just pulling their hair out, you know, because you there's bureaucracy, there's red tape, all of those kind of things. A lot of the companies that I saw ensured that there was everybody's on the same page. So
internally.
Okay. The communication sounds simple enough because big companies got intranet, you got you know all of those kind of things, but it's amazing when you start digging into it and you know we've got stats that we provide in the masterclass because you're talking to the executives mainly of these companies that the vision that they have. Does not necessarily translate all the way down.
Absolutely.
So if people don't understand what the strategy or the purpose is, I'm very big on purpose.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not a vision statement and it's not a strategy. It is what is your purpose? So everybody's purpose would have pivoted in the last 3 to 5 years. You cannot tell me that your purpose has not changed in recent time. And I'll give you an example. So there are a lot of furniture companies, a company like IKEA, that Flatpak,
yes.
their purpose is to furnish your home as quickly as possible and as affordably as you can.
Okay.
Domino's Pizza. A lot of people say, well, they're doing a lot of marketing gimmicks. They delivering a pizza by drone, by a little terrestrial robot, you know, it cooks as it's coming towards your front door, yeah. and then you open the door. I said, but that's a different purpose. It's a pizza company, but their purpose is to serve you a piping hot pizza at your front door.
Yes.
Once you establish that purpose, it puts your company on a very, very different trajectory. You start looking at different skills that need to be put into those logistics or what you want to achieve. Mm. The ecosystem of the company needs to change, all of those kind of things. So getting people all on the same platform is really, really important. And it's surprising, or maybe unsurprising, you know, that the larger the corporation, that people just don't know. So we stepped into a massive multinational ad agency called RGA.
In New York,
RGA. So they just moved into two floors of spanking new offices, amazing real estate, overlooking the Hudson River. They literally just moved in. They said, oh, please don't take pictures of the furniture that's being unpacked because we want to make sure that everything looks nice.
Yeah.
What is interesting with that, so these are just ways and means of how companies do things very subtly, and you don't think of this as innovation, but it is. So on the two floors, you could only enter the advertising agency on one floor. And the reason they did that, we said, so how come you block the one floor? Can't you just get people there?
Yeah.
They said, we've got 900 people in this office. Okay. Some of the time, nobody knows that you actually work for the same company. So just by funneling people through one entrance, you actually just forcing people to bump into each other every day and understand who they are. then if you went into their very large kind of reception area, there's a big pause area where people can just sit and have coffee and stuff like that. They had screens, huge screens surrounding, wrapping around this whole area, and they kept playing the ads that they had produced. So we said, you know, is that just a showcase? They said, look, it's sort of a showcase for the clients that come in, but they said it's more important because with 900 people in one agency, people would say, oh, did we do that Nike ad? Did we do that ad?
Yeah.
And you're going, yeah, we did. You know, so it's like you can't work for that company and not understand that you did, you know, that was part of what that company did. So
yes.
It's like simple things like that. So you go down to a smaller company, like we popped into Warby Parker. So Warby Parker is an eyewear company.
Yes.
They started online.
Yes.
Then they went offline. So they did an Amazon and they started doing this sort of tango between online and offline. But they have a specific department called a culture team.
Okay.
And they have what they call weekly or monthly lunch roulettes. And they randomly pick people from the company and they say, here's some nice budget, go have a nice lunch together and get to know each other.
Wow.
What that does is not only get to know each other, but get to know each other's divisions and problems within that division. So
yes.
you understand that silo has this problems and maybe you can help and everything. And that's why I say, you know, siloed companies and hierarchical companies are very counterproductive to innovation and to disruption because you can't think like that anymore. You need to have a much flatter structure. So what we always advocate is the old thing is I wanted to work up the corporate ladder. I'm going to be the CEO and I'm going to have a nice corner office with a view. And I want to be the king of the castle. You now no longer should be wanting to be the king of the castle. You want to be the center of the circle. So you want to have like a planetary thing with all of your teams orbiting around you.
I see.
So that you can make those quick decisions and that so that everybody's kind of on that same level so that you can operate things a lot quicker. So, you know, even some of the things I did, the talks I do, the confirmation process, because it's got to go up the hierarchical ladder, this one's got to sign it off, then that one's going to sign it off,
yeah.
Then it's got to sign it off. You know, it's like, guys, that takes too long. You need to think smarter. You need to work much quicker and faster because that's the nature of where we are in the world. So
just quickly, I mean, I'm imagining a senior executive of a large organization at this point folding their arms and sitting back and saying, you know, it's all good and well to talk about these things and probably make reference to your New York tour and say those things work well because those companies kind of lend themselves to being innovative or to adapting very quickly.
Yeah.
How do we adapt that to your more traditional players? You know, I mean, if we look at a large government parastatal, for example, a large financial services organizations that by nature of the work they do, you know, they're tied by legislation, they're tied by regulations. So how do they translate that and make that more practical for themselves?
So, I mean, the first thing and fundamental, and it doesn't matter if you're a parastatal or a state-owned enterprise or anything like that, is just the chain of command. I think that for me is a really outdated way of doing business.
So
in the masterclass that we do, there's a whole lot of checkpoints. And one of the checkpoints is allowing people to question the status quo. And I think those structures don't do that. So if you are that CEO that's listening, is, you know, do you have mechanisms where those innovation ideas can come from every sector of the company?
Yes.
Is there a way of having some kind of autonomy within different departments so they can make decisions a lot quicker? And you know, do you allow those ideas to bubble up instead of trickle down? And I think that question about can people question the status quo is not conducive to the business structures that we see at the moment.
Yes.
Because we have a chain of command.
Absolutely.
I am your senior, this is this manager, this is whatever. And what you're finding. So the one company that I found most interesting, because it was a trend company, and I wanted to see what their methodology was, and I was pleased to find out that we have very, very similar methodologies. But the one thing that they do is every single day, and it's compulsory for the whole staff, to attend a sharing briefing at lunchtime. So everybody has to go there, but everybody can invite other people. So the cleaning lady sits there, the coffee person sits there, everybody from the senior executives to whatever, all sit in on this thing, and everybody shares, because it's an information and a trend company,
yes,
what they found.
I see.
And as things pop up, you just saw the whole sharing thing happen there, because once it said, oh, we've seen this thing happening here, there's a trend there, maybe it's not a trend, maybe it's a fad, whatever, but then somebody said, oh, but we're working with this client with that, that should actually fit into this, we can use it as a case study there, and suddenly you just saw this cross-pollination of stuff that's going around, and that, I think, is lacking from that kind of corporate structure. So, yes, I get it, that especially, say, if we're talking about financial services, you know, there's a lot of regulations, and you can't kind of move out. I beg to differ, because there are a lot of players coming in to nibble away at the foundations of financial services who Absolutely. Are not financial services providers. They are, take for example, WeChat in China.
Yes.
WeChat, that's our version of WhatsApp, but it's huge in the East. But a WeChat wallet is fundamental to you getting around in China, because they are almost a cashless society already. And having a WeChat wallet and paying with your WeChat wallet is one of the most common ways of doing things, and that's not a bank.
Okay.
You know?
Yes.
So you're going, okay, there's a lot of things that are, you know, that are happening. So when people say, oh, no, we can't do this, then it means that you are blinkered by your own perceptions of where the borders are and where the limitations are.
Yeah.
And these the younger startup companies, all of those things, don't see those limitations.
But I guess then the question would be, because I know you say, you know, innovation should by and large come from within. But in most cases we see disruption coming from an external force, an external factor.
Yeah.
With that challenge, because obviously, you know, what you'd understand would be the way that you've done things, you're trying to work within the regulations or the rules, and so being disruptive almost becomes counterintuitive from that perspective. So how do we then marry the two? You know, bringing in, you know, this disruptive force, but also, I guess, leveraging their legacy, as it were?
Yes. So, we talk a lot about ambidextrous leadership.
Yes.
So being able to write with both hands, but also to manage those dual strategies. And that's so paradoxical for a lot of leadership. Why should I disrupt the boat? And if we're talking sort of C-suite, in a lot of cases, you've got a CEO that comes in. There's possibly a limited number of years that they're contracted to before they either move on. So a lot of them don't want to disrupt the ship too much. You know, so they're like, let's just keep it going. We keep the shareholders happy, and we're not going to do too much change, because I don't want to have that like legacy, or if it goes wrong, or whatever. So we'll just keep cruising along. And I think that's the one fundamental problem, which goes back to what we were saying, is a lot of people are scared or don't see the need to invest in that future bucket to do that. So if you're looking at innovation, that is one of the things that really is very counterproductive for that. So first thing is, a lot of companies have an innovation hub. Okay. And I say it is counterproductive to outsource your innovation. So when I first put this talk together, and we were launching this report about innovation, I had a lot of people from innovation hubs in the room, and I was a bit nervous to say this, like in front of them. And when I said, you know, innovation hubs are actually counterproductive, they all started nodding. And the reason they nodded, and the reason why I said it, was because what happens with an innovation hub is that CEO or the rest of the company say, they fold their arms and they sit back and they say, that's your role.
And let's see what comes out.
Come up with a silver bullet that's going to just transform the fortunes of this company, and we'll all sit back and we'll wait for it to happen. So these poor guys are under stress, and I've spoken to a lot of guys in innovation hubs. And the problem is not the ideas. They're not short of ideas. The one guy that moved from different innovation hubs said at his last job, there were about 17 things to implement, that ideas that they had.
That are ready for implementation.
Yeah, but they couldn't get through the stack of to-do list to try and undo that, because obviously that you know, trying that one innovation thing is going to be is costly, and it takes quite a lot of time. So they said it's not that, but it is about trying to implement. So what you find a lot in some C-suites in different countries is there's a fast turnaround and a churn. So you'll get a CEO or someone that champions that bit of innovation, and then they leave. And then once the champion's gone, then nobody champions it, then it dies down, and then you go. So you go, you know, two steps forward and then three steps back again, and it's very disheartening for those teams. And again, if everybody sits and folds their hands and says, "Well, you innovate, you know, for us,"
yeah,
then and going to what I said before about the whole ecosystem and everybody being involved in it and understanding where the purpose and the trajectory is going, having that outsource innovation doesn't help anybody. Because everybody just sits and waits for this innovation to happen.
Yeah.
And it's not an entity. So a lot of the time I say to companies is looking at your own ecosystem and how the company is structured is innovation in itself. Rethink that. So what you were saying, you know, we were saying about, well, you know, you've got the structure, it's hard, it's a slow ship to turn.
Yes.
But in one of my classes for one of the universities, I said to one guy, said he's really, really amped. He loved what he was talking about. Think about the innovation and what he can do about it. He says, but I'm a logistics manager in a warehouse, and I can't change the whole company culture. So how do I take my excitement and implement it there? So I said, have you asked your department or your little fiefdom if they want to work differently? He said, no. I said, you can ask them if there's just a way of doing, without disrupting the functionality of that department and the company.
Yes.
But, you know, if they're shift workers or something, there's probably a little tweak that you can do which will make them really, really, really happy to do things. And he's like, okay, I'm going to do that on Monday. And I said, you know, you can, it doesn't, you don't have to change the entire beast. You can change small things, and that's what I meant about, you know, making small departments a little bit more autonomous. Take, you know, say, how do you guys want to do that? Don't shake the entire ecosystem, but if you can do something differently or more smart, work smarter, then go ahead and, you know, and implement that.
Yeah.
So that concept's known as holacracy. So it's companies allowing different departments to self-govern or make decisions for themselves.
So that the innovation can then brew from within and then eventually
spread. Holacracies aren't for everybody, because basically you're saying, this department there, you've got, you almost like autonomous, you can make your own decisions as you go along. So some managers don't like getting let going of their power.
Yes.
And some of the worker ends don't want to take the responsibility of making those decisions. So holacracies are very tricky, but it can implement. If I talk about holacracies, then there's a fundamental problem with recruitment and trusting your staff.
Yes.
Okay, so one of my case studies from that masterclass was Netflix.
Okay.
So Netflix they said they're trying to eliminate organizational drag. Okay, so they don't ask you. So if you're doing stuff for the company, you don't have to put in your slips and
The expense claims and all of that.
Expense claims and all of that kind of stuff. Because they said, we're assuming that we are hiring you and you are working in the best interests of your company.
Yes.
I think fundamentally, a lot of companies don't trust the employers, the employees.
It's guilty until proven innocent.
Which means you've hired the wrong people. You can't trust them to just do what's best for the company. Then you hire, you know, the wrong people. Then we can have a whole different conversation. I had it this morning with somebody that you know, talking about new ways of recruitment. So if we're talking about skills, then you hire for attitude, you retrain for skills. So, you know, so like a whole bank of you know, your academic learning sometimes not going to fit into a company culture. That's why you retrain for skills and you hire for that attitude. So it is about those employer employee relationships again.
Yes.
And it just keeps striking when I talk a lot to really rigid corporate structures about remote working. They go, no, we can't do that. We want to clock people, clock in, you know, 9 to 5. And I'm saying, but that's a it's a rather quaint and outdated, 20th century notion of work.
Yes.
You work a 40-hour work week. It starts at 9, it ends at 5. And like, why do we all have to get to the one place at the same time in the morning when we all actually work remotely?
Yes.
And technically we all do. Yeah. Every single person that is listening has answered an email on their phones outside of offered hours.
Absolutely.
You're working remotely. We don't have to do this. So there's a lot of ways of not only recruiting but also making people happy and how they want to work. So the kind of the future of work is parallel to the future of business, and that for me is also innovation. So people must stop thinking of innovation as this tech gadget or the app or something that's going to happen. A lot of the time they can innovate internally, and that's what I see not happening.
Okay, so let's talk about a few tools. I mean, we've kind of set the scene in terms of what's happening, but I know there's some trends that you have kind of distilled.
Yes.
And we speak about these three economies.
Yeah.
Gig economy, the on-demand economy, and the sharing economy.
Yeah.
And they potentially become enablers for business as part of strategy.
Sure.
Right. In terms of how they can position themselves for a digitally transforming, disruptive world.
Yeah.
So can we talk through those economies and kind of the learnings in each of those and how those can become practical?
Sure. So let's talk about the gig economy, because that's what I was talking about. People wanting to work differently.
Yes.
And especially if you look at the kind of very generalized but quite accurate behavioral patterns of a millennial workforce, and then we at Flux already are focusing on Gen Z.
Okay.
So sorry, millennials, you've had your day in the sun.
Your time is over.
Your time is over. We're moving on. And because Gen Z's are your adolescents, your teenagers, and they are now the eldest ones are finishing school. They're coming into tertiary education. They're coming into the workforce. So these guys are not only your new workforce, they're your new consumer. They're going to start earning money.
Yes.
And that's a very, very different way of doing things. So if you look at those two generational groups, that 9-to-5, the one job that defines me is not going to work. So you've got that slashy mentality. I do a lot of jobs simultaneously. So the whole thing about gig working is growing and growing and growing in tandem with remote working.
Okay.
So that's going to change everything. And if you go back again to what I'm saying is, all of these things, our labor laws, the factories and how we constructed, corporations, business templates, are all spawned in what, mid-20th century kind of thing. Everything's changed now.
Yes.
So we haven't changed with that. So we still apply those 20th century work, labor laws, all of those kind of things. And you're seeing the disruption in, say, like a ride sharing, whether it's Uber, Spotify, Deliveroo, all of these guys, they're not classified as employees. Uber says they're partner drivers.
Yeah.
There's like, where do we go there? We haven't got new boxes to put these things in.
Yes.
So gig work is going to just increase, and you're starting to see very big companies latch onto that. So one example is Amazon. So unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because they do amazing things, Amazon's not really prevalent in South Africa, but Amazon, where they are, have a program called Amazon Flex.
Okay.
So that's exactly, they've taken a leaf out of Uber, and it's a gig working scenario. So they want to become the fastest online retailer globally. So Amazon Prime Now means that you are able to order something. So this is in the cities where they really dominate. And within an hour of you pressing buy on your tablet, your phone, whatever, you will have that delivery within the hour or 2 hours at most.
Okay.
And
so effectively, from the time I press the button
to say yes,
I want to purchase,
it'll arrive at your front door. I had a researcher that was stationed in Seattle, and she did a test for me.
Okay.
And she said it arrived within an hour. The way they do that, that's what I find business so fascinating. So Amazon Flex program says we need delivery people. We need a distribution network.
Okay.
So maybe you're unemployed, maybe you're a stay-at-home mom, you miraculously have 2 hours for free. Yeah. You join the Amazon Flex program. It's very much like an Uber thing. You need a car, you need an Android phone, and we'll sign you up, and we'll pay you per kilometer to do the stuff. And basically, all you do is deliver goods within your neighborhood for Amazon. And that is why you see their business strategy of buying the Whole Foods group. So anybody who's been to America would be familiar with Whole Foods. They not only buying the other company, they buying the real estate of where all of those branches of Whole Foods are.
So that they can have a footing into all those neighborhoods.
Exactly. And so it's much easier, especially it's hard to deliver perishable goods.
Absolutely.
So Whole Foods solves two problems. You can store the perishable goods in the centers, and then you can distribute much quicker. It's a very clever strategy to kind of do that. So the gig economy is going to grow. It's forming, and people are starting to understand it. But again, if we go back to corporate culture, we don't quite understand the concept of work swarms. So at Flux, I have to walk the talk. So we use work swarms. We've got a small sort of permanent team, and then we just bring in different team members with different strengths for different projects.
Okay.
Because you start to look at work as a much more modular way of doing things. So per project, per this, whatever, whatever, and you bring one swarm in to handle that job. The swarm disbands. The next swarm comes in for a different job. Some of the members of the other swarm would come in, but not necessarily. So you keep adjusting it according to client brief or the project or whatever. So
that's is that not similar to contract work that we've had in the past?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the key difference?
There's not really. It's just kind of a freelancing. It's just they're calling it the gig economy because it's become so widespread.
Okay. So it's becoming the norm.
It's becoming the norm slowly, slowly.
Okay.
So if you look at that, then you go to the sharing economy and the same kind of thing. Well, the sharing economy and on demand is let's talk about on-demand, because that fed into the gig economy. So with this Amazon Flex program, people want it. I want it now. I want it seamless. I want it as quick as possible. And that, you see, has completely changed specifically retail. We've just finished a whole body of research in terms of the new rules of retail.
Okay.
And the biggest findings there is that your last mile from getting your product to the customer has been digitized and is on demand. And that is completely disrupting and changing the nature of how you do retail. So, you know, if you're listening and you've got a bricks and mortar store, you need to extend the store function of that. You need to rethink what you do with that real estate. You can do stuff with it in closing times. There's different ways of doing things there, but also meeting your customer halfway. So we've looked at a lot of case studies where you're starting to see people just push that what they sell, and it's not just a product anymore. I'll get into that, but you meet the customer halfway, or you take it to the customer. So
What do you mean by that?
So, for example, one of the most clever things that we've seen, I've just done something for an alcohol chain. So two examples. One was in hospitality. So a company, it's a Scandinavian company, they're targeting female business travelers.
Okay.
So you, for the female business traveler, and with all the algorithms, you kind of know what that person wants in a different city. So maybe you go there, you're suddenly invited out to this business dinner, you don't have the little black dress or the shoes or whatever. They bring a fashion minibar into your hotel room.
Oh.
So very much like little bottles of beverage.
Yes.
You open your closet and there's some clothes hanging there. And they're all designed for like emergencies, or I want to go to gym, I don't have any shoes.
Before you even get there. Request it.
No.
It's like there. A mini bar, but
it's fresh. Yeah. And basically whatever you want to take, it's like a mini bar. It's just added to your bill at the end and you go home with the stuff. But you use it while you're there. So another example is a vodka brand. I went to the brand. So that's what I was saying to these guys. They're saying, you know, oh, should we deliver? I'm like, why are you even asking that question?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what do you deliver is more the question. So this vodka brand, they not only deliver, and it's on demand. So there's a promo video. You can see this woman. She's sort of at a party, and she's like, okay, I want to order this. It'll be with you in 5 minutes. Nice hipster guy comes in with a box, and he's not only bringing the vodka, but he's bringing a whole mixology kit.
I see.
So it's like you're taking not only the product to the customer, you're taking a solution and a service.
I see.
So it's that's why I said to these guys, don't just think of delivery. It's like,
what else?
What else are you delivering with that service to create that? You know, so it's just meeting people halfway, and then within that, there's a whole lot of variations of click and collect.
Okay.
So I buy an order online, I either collect there instead of them delivering to me. So we've seen with hybrid on and off retail, there's just so many different fragmented business models that have come out of that. So that's the kind of stuff that you need to look at.
Okay.
This is all driven by the on-demand economy.
Okay.
Then if we go to the sharing economy, that's a big chat, because it's your companies like Airbnb, it's your car sharing companies like Uber, Taxify here in South Africa, Lyft in America.
Okay.
We are understanding with a sharing economy, and that is being more and more pronounced, specifically in a millennial mindset, and then we go to Gen Z, it's just going to pronounce. We do not have to own something to necessarily enjoy it or experience it.
Yes.
So very much like the car riding and stuff. I'm not a driver. I'm a rider.
Okay.
If I don't have to drive ever again, we're really, really happy about that. And I'm not a petrol head, so my car does not define me.
Yes. Okay.
So I drive a little smart. My petrol cost is 350 rand a month.
Lucky
I'm
you.
Very happy with that.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think smarter with that and the sharing economy. So you're getting to a point where a lot of people are starting to question, the more these ride-sharing apps embed themselves, people are saying, do I need to buy a car? Do I need to own this car? So yes. I know a lot of people that live in, say, Cape Town, City Bowl, they can get around a lot. I stick in my hood in Joburg, so I don't really drive a lot, and I'm traveling most of the time. So do I actually need to buy a new car?
Yes.
So as a result, so I mean, how's this for a big pivot? So Ford, and I picked this up 2 years ago, they said they were going to pivot into digital mobility.
Okay.
So they're not going to stop creating and building cars, but they understand that the digital mobility, the growing industry, is worth double the current automotive industry.
Yes.
To just make the cars. So they, and literally last week, I had a fantastic trend confirmation, and the next time I'm in New York, I want to go there. So near the World Trade Center, the Oculus Center, they've opened a permanent showroom that talks about a future without cars. This is a car manufacturer.
Ford. Yes.
Talking about a future
without cars.
Of mobility. So they're talking about mobility, they're not talking about cars. They'll still make the cars,
yes,
to feed into the mobility, but they understand that that's where we're going and we want to be more mobile. And so that's your sharing economy just starting to kick in and saying, yeah, do we need all of this stuff? So the mantra, and this was the other findings for our retail research, is it's a real tough one for retailers.
Yeah.
Because there's a large section of people, especially in older demographics, like, I don't want more stuff.
Mm.
I want stories. I want memories.
Yes.
I want experiences. So what are those, you know, experiences? So it's travel, it's go out, eating out, going with friends,
yes,
you know, all of those kind of things. And the research we did with Gen Z, that's going to be a really tough one. So if you're a fashion retailer and you're listening, you would normally be rubbing your hands with a teenage demographic saying, ah, we're going to sell them a lot of fast fashion.
Yeah, the latest and the greatest.
And the latest, everything like that. Not so much. Generally speaking, you've got a very world-wise Gen Z group, these teenagers. They're post-recession generation. They're post-9/11 generation. They've seen war and terrorism sometime firsthand. They understand climate change, eco-sustainability, all of that kind of stuff. They're not necessarily wanting stuff. They,
yes,
like tech. Their gadgets and technology supersedes the need for fashion and clothing. And also, if you think about it, they're a social media generation.
Okay.
So my experiences define who I am more so than the product I'm actually buying. If I get the product, it's sort of a bonus.
Yes.
Secondary. It's more about saying
the experiences that I can showcase.
So on that point, there's another disruption that brands and retailers have to deal with. And these are one of these non-tech disruptors that people don't see. So if you look at Gen Z, I will give my very rare brand loyalty to a brand if they mirror my value systems. Okay. And mirroring the value systems has become really, really, really important. And for big businesses, specifically the big brands, but especially your corporate companies, it's never been their role to say, this is where we stand on LGBT rights or whatever, you know. So we're saying these businesses need to be woke.
Yeah.
You need to really get with the program, because suddenly these little undercurrents of pop culture and socio-political kind of stuff, the whole fees must fall, Black Lives Matter, all of these kind of things are starting to really make sure that this is where your brand stands out. And so there's a global survey, Havas Global did a worldwide survey, and the respondents was very interesting. Globally, 80% of the people said it is up to brands, big businesses, to push for positive change alongside government. It's not just government's responsibility to change. So suddenly you're in this business, all you do is look at the bottom line, you keep your shareholders happy. Now suddenly you've actually got to go out, stick your neck out and say, these are our value systems and this is where we stand on stuff.
And what have you seen? I mean, what companies have you seen case studies of companies kind of starting to play in the space?
So the closest one to home, well, we've actually seen examples of that. So it was last year, Pastor Anderson, the guy that was going to come here, and people just, they said, this guy's a bigot, a homophobe, whatever, we don't want him.
Okay.
And Malusi Gigaba was the Home Affairs Minister at that stage, and he was bombed on Twitter to say, like, do not let this guy in.
Okay.
Eventually they didn't let him, but I remember it was like Wimpy or Spur, because this pastor said, oh, he's going to visit these places, and they actually came out and they said, please don't come to any of our stores, we do not want this happening. And we're seeing it with these kind of racist incidences, you know, happening.
Yes.
With that, the really fun ones, well, Nando's Washington, because of Trump, the gift that keeps giving, in this regard.
Yes.
When he announced like the Muslim ban and all of those kind of things, you saw people come out immediately saying, Airbnb did it, Nando's did it, you know, we welcome everybody into our restaurants. My favorite ones were focused, and they're very recent, was two examples. One was during International Pride Month, which was June.
Okay.
Skittles, we don't have Skittles in South Africa, but it's like a little kind of M&M's type sweet. It's normally rainbow colors, okay?
Yes.
And they said, in Pride Month, there's only one rainbow that actually matters, which was for Pride. And they changed all of their packaging and all of their sweets to pure white. Do you know what a logistic nightmare that must have been to repackage, like, for a whole month or whatever, all of your signature sweets that are multicolored to just make them white, and all of the packaging to, you know, to make them white? But this is kind of what you have to do. Ben and Jerry's ice cream in Australia, because they're fighting marriage equality, same-sex marriages, and it's being pushed in. So what they did from May, they said, from May, we are banning anybody who wants a double scoop of the same flavor of ice cream. So unless we can have marriage equality, you can't have two scoops of the same ice cream. I just think it's a really brilliant thing. It gets a brand noticed, but it takes into account this kind of disruptive force of pop culture that you, and being woke, and brands being woke, and companies being woke, and saying, hey, we need this kind of thing. Because what they understand is they want those young and more diverse customers, but they also want those young and more diverse customers to come and work for them.
Yes.
And if the brands don't stick their necks out and say, this is what we stand for, those younger guys are going to say, well, I'm not going to come and work for you. I don't believe in your value systems.
I don't align.
Good. Yeah. There's no, what is your social impact policy? What is your this? You know, these are the questions these young guys are going to ask them. And if they don't have the answers and say, well, you know, we just look after the shareholders and our bottom line, then you're going to say, well, actually, I don't know if I really want to work for you, if that's the mentality.
And I mean, if you think back to I mean, I guess our generation, you're probably asking, okay, what are the benefits that you offer?
Yeah.
What is the pension plan or,
no, exactly.
You know, all these kind of, I guess, money-orientated things, and it's gone beyond that.
No, absolutely. You know, it's a whole different thing. And the mantra, especially for a younger workforce, is don't give me a job, give me a lifestyle. And it makes a lot of sense. And if you layer onto what I said earlier about remote working and, you know, the kind of the blurred lines of we don't work 9 to 5. You know, yes. you carry on. You're doing stuff. So that lifestyle is really important. And working for that company that resonates with my value systems is part of that lifestyle. I'm not coming to you for a job. I want that lifestyle. I want to feel connected to this. I want to feel that I'm doing good through what I do there. Yes, I want to earn a salary, and yes, I do want those things. But there's a higher purpose to it, which is I go all the way back to what we were talking about earlier, and what I hammer home over and over and over and over to our clients is, what is your purpose? Because your purpose defines that. Or eases the disruptive process, because once you've very clearly defined your purpose and you've communicated it to the rest of the, you know, the company, then everybody gets it and says, okay, this is what we're working for. We are trying to do this. And it can't be a nice mission statement. You know, it can't be something that's a little bit odd. It's got to resonate with everybody. And it's like, okay, this is the purpose of what we're doing. So it's like, you know, if you're a pizza company, we are delivering you a piping hot pizza at your front door.
It can't get clearer than that.
Yeah, you know, so nothing be a mission statement like we use fresh produce or whatever. Like, no, we're delivering that pizza there. You know, that's a very specific thing.
And so, Dion, I want to bring it closer to home, specifically in South Africa. I mean, you operate from here, as much as you've got a very global perspective.
Yes.
What do you see emerging as a trend for business, specifically in South Africa, And how do you see that playing out over the next while?
Well, look, I see. Okay, so on the downside, unfortunately there's quite a lot of downsides. There is that we're still dealing the level of the companies that I deal with, still dealing with digital transformation is a bit concerning for me.
Yes,
because like we should be much further along the path of that. And then, you know, the whole talk of the fourth industrial revolution comes in, and how to manage that. That said, if I look at those small players that are nibbling away at the foundations of, say, the financial services industry, that gives me a lot of hope, because you've got these young entrepreneurs that are trying to do things with
South African.
South African, yeah. Okay. Case in point, somebody actually used to write for me has started an uber disruptive app for landlords and people who want to rent.
Okay.
So he puts them together, things called House Me, and in 6 months of launching, they have signed up the same number of landlords wanting to rent out their places as estate agents who have been running for 10 years or longer.
Wow.
So you see, and the reason why I'm mentioning him specifically is because he did his homework, okay? He was also had a very promising career as an investment banker.
Okay.
And after being put in hospital, after being staring at a screen for how many hours, he just said, and again, that goes to that whole mantra of, I don't want a job, I want a lifestyle. He's like, sod this. This is not what I want to spend my days with. So he decided to be this entrepreneur. He went to Silicon Valley. He went to India to app develop. So he did it really properly. I mean, a lot of research went into this thing. And what that company is doing is also offering, you know, a little bit of financial services, everything. So he's going to nibble there. But the one thing he said to me was, when he went to Silicon Valley, the one thing was very clear. He said, in South Africa, we don't have a shortage of ideas. We have a shortage of big companies who want to support. He says, if you're in Silicon Valley and you kind of get onto the radar and say, I've got something new, he says, you just get all of these companies sniffing around saying, what have you got? What are you working on? There's an interest there.
Okay.
In South Africa, we sit back and we wait and say, oh, that's proven itself. Then we'll come and knock on your door and we invest. We don't help the guys. We don't enable them from the ground up.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big stumbling block of what we need to do.
Okay. So we do see then these smaller companies, I guess, starting to emerge in our economy.
Yeah.
Starting to, I guess, also make their presence known in terms of, you know, disrupting some of the larger established industries.
And for me, what we've got in our as a positive for us is, especially on the whole continent, I'm not talking just South Africa,
yes,
but in Africa, is for me solution-based innovation. So that for me is the big lighthouse and the guiding light that we need to look at in Africa, because sometimes, or more often than not, we don't have the infrastructure, we don't have the financing to do it. But we'll solve the problem differently.
Yes.
And you see the effects of the makers' fairs that they have throughout the continent. So that's just getting a whole lot of people together, show some technology. Don't tell them what the technology does. Just say, this is how it works. See what you can come up with. And, yes. You know, you've got people that put together 3D printing 3D printers from old technology, whatever, in Nigeria for 16-year-old schoolgirls. 16-year-old
wow.
figured out a way of generating electricity using urine.
Sure.
And you're going, how the hell did that happen?
Yeah.
You know? So it's that, and that's why I say it. So for me, innovation is what everybody's searching for. Solution-based innovation is one notch up from that because it has purpose.
Yeah.
It solves problems. It solves problems that are very specific to Africa about communication, about potable water, about sustainable energy, about all of those kind of things. And if I look into my little business crystal ball, that is also the future of business, is philanthropic business, or let's call it conscious capitalism.
Okay.
So, yes, we all want to make some money, but we want to enable people, and we want to bring people with us as we grow
and improve the world.
Yes. So it's not so, you know, it's not just bottom line driven. It can't just be about the bottom line anymore. And yeah. I know if you're a CFO listening, then that kind of hurts you, but but it's true. We can't just have this. If you look at the inequality that's growing around the world, and then specifically with a knowledge economy and technology coming through, we're going to get technological inequality, and okay. any kind of inequality is not good for the whole society. So businesses have got to rethink, disrupt themselves in that way, and think how can they contribute to not just looking at the bottom line, but looking for the greater good of everybody. And
okay.
it's a very new role of business.
In fact, that's a wonderful place for us to lead into the wrap for the show for today, because there's two questions I ask all the guests, and they're very simple, really. The first one being your vision for South Africa and Africa as a continent. What would that look like?
Sure. It's to get on that technological express train, because we've really got to up that, you know, like I've been saying for this whole conversation is I'm very concerned that we're still struggling with digital transformation. It should be already a given. Maybe it's just the world I live in that it is a given.
I agree with you.
But,
yeah.
but we need to do that. We see and all the enablers, whether it's data, it's the data costs, all of those things. So data must fall definitely.
Yes.
Those fees must fall definitely. So that's my vision there, is to enable people. Because if you look at the makers' fairs, if you look at all of those things, I visited a robot exhibition in London. When you look at the little kids coming into that exhibition, they weren't freaked out about these machines or robots. They didn't say, what is that?
Yeah.
They went up to each individual, and these are like 9, 10-year-old guys, went up to the robots and said, what do you do? They spoke directly to the robot, you know. So it's like you've got an understanding of this. We've got to enable that. So that's for me is get everybody on the tech express train.
Okay. And then my final question is, how do you define disruption? I mean, you live in that world, but if you were to distill it for me very quickly, how would you define disruption?
For me, it's about changing business templates. And I think a lot of people see disruption as an external force, and I see disruption as a positive thing if you look internally into a company, and that's about those ecosystems, your people, and what to do with those people, and how you change the structure of that company internally. And for me, that's a good disruption.
Fantastic. And an industry one. Fantastic. Dion, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We could have spoken for another hour.
You got me on my passion wagon there. So. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us on the show again today. To our sponsors, T-Systems, once again, for making the platform possible, for bringing in the disruptors who really share knowledge with us on a weekly basis. Thank you to T-Systems South Africa. You can follow T-Systems on www.unoutsourced.co.za to get more information on what services they can offer, and also to download the podcast, you can go to unoutsourced.co.za. Until next week, thank you very much for joining me, Mpumi Nhlapo, on Disrupt. We'll see you next time.
This is CliffCentral.com.